This is Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. David Brock, described by his friends as a notorious right-wing hitman and partisan attack machine, tells all in his latest book, Blinded by the Right, The Conscience of an Ex-Conservative. Peace Watch spoke with Brock this week about his former life as a right-winger and about the increasingly conservative media coverage of the peace movement and the impending war with Iraq.
The story that I tell is kind of an inside story of the effort by Republican conservatives, first with the issue of trying to control the courts during the first Bush administration, and then the campaign against President Clinton in the 90s. What was going on the inside organizationally, how it was funded, and what the execution strategies were. My role was, I was in various different conservative publications, beginning at the Washington Times, moving to the American Spectator with a stint in between there at a conservative think tank, the Heritage Foundation. But it was basically as a propagandist. I called myself a journalist, but that really wasn't it, and that wasn't really what anybody was doing that I was working with in those publications, to publicly execute the strategy of, as I said, first defending the judicial nominees of the first Bush administration, particularly Clarence Thomas, and then, beginning very early on when Bill Clinton first announced for the presidency, there was an awful lot going on below the radar screen by people who were connected to Newt Gingrich, who were financing these so-called journalistic investigations of the Clintons that ultimately, did... Some of them did become published, and then I describe not only what the goals of the conservatives were in the Clinton administration, but how conservatives, including the American Spectator, including some of my own work, were able to alter the consciousness of the mainstream press and able to essentially, in some ways, co-opt that press into doing fulfilling the agenda of the right wing.
Now, those are pretty strong words. When you say you were able to alter the consciousness of the mainstream press,
right?
How would you even begin to do something to accomplish something like that?
Well, I'll give you an example. One of the first stories that I wrote for the American Spectator on Clinton was the so-called Troopergate scandal, and that involved allegations by his former bodyguards of his personal past indiscretions while he was governor of Arkansas. Now, that issue really hadn't been broached in the mainstream press up to that point. Certainly some reporters poked around, but no one published anything. The floodgates opened as a result of Troopergate. I had mentioned in passing in that article a woman named Paula, who ended up being Paula Jones. So that article triggered her lawsuit against Clinton. And, in fact, the day the Troopergate story was released, it was featured on CNN that evening. And so there was a process by which what had been, I think, some of the normal or typical journalistic standards were worn down by the conservative campaign against Clinton. And I certainly don't think that you would have seen that kind of tabloization of mainstream press if the conservatives hadn't pushed the envelope first.
So it was your job to raise the issues and write the stories. Was there some sort of mechanism in place that would move that information? Was there a pipeline? You said it ended up on CNN that night. Was that part of a strategy, a planned strategy, or just coincidence?
It was. And that goes back to, a strategy that I had learned from the publisher of my first book. My first book was a book that was extremely critical of Anita Hill and supportive of Clarence Thomas. And there were explicit strategies employed. That was a conservative-oriented publishing imprint called the Free Press. And there were specific strategies that were discussed in terms of the promotion of that book to inject the conservative point of view into the mainstream press. And one of those strategies was to say that the book was objective when it wasn't, and a certain smoothing out of the rhetoric to make it more palatable for the mainstream, even though the messages were the same.
Now, did anyone actually give you those directives to say that this book is objective if it's not?
Yes. In fact, there was a media coaching session that I went through for that book, and that is how I was coached. And I don't think I was the first one to go through that.
And so with regard to this impending war with Iraq, now that you're out in the cold, so to speak,
right.
Can you kind of see the invisible lines or strings being pulled between the mainstream media and the conservatives? Do you see connections there? What is your thinking about what is taking place with the way this particular war is being portrayed in the media?
Well, yeah, I do. I mean, I think that, first of all, I think that the conservative media, and by that I mean most of talk radio, most of the discussion on cable television, and the op-ed pages in the country, I think the conservative media increasingly is setting the tone for the rest of the discussion. And I see that in the war. I see that in a lot of places, but particularly with the war. And so I think there's been a tendency among Democrats and liberals to not pay so much attention, for example, to what's said on some of these more extreme right-wing radio shows. And I think that's a mistake, because I do think that you can't have that kind of noise going on day in and day out and entering, you know, affecting the atmosphere without it having some spillover effect. For example, the questioning of the motives of people who are against the war, the questioning of their patriotism, these things have come out of the conservative world, but I do think they've affected and had kind of a bit of an intimidating effect on the rest of the press. So that's one dynamic. There are others. There are specific strategies. For example, after the tragedy of 9/11, there's a group called the Media Research Center, which is a right-wing media monitoring organization. And in their direct mail, they talk about their specific strategy after 9/11 to target people in the mainstream press and to question their patriotism if they were not fully supportive of what President Bush was doing in terms of the war on terror.
Can you think of any specific examples where that actually happened?
Yes, there was one. I mean, there was more than one, but Peter Jennings was asked in some sort of forum a question, and his answer was, he answered that Americans have different views of patriotism. And the Media Research Center got that quote, and they said in their statement that Jennings was a Canadian, had Canadian citizenship, and was not an American, and was betraying the fact that he was unpatriotic in that statement. And so I think those things are happening, and I think the effects are, you know, subtle. They're not that easy to document, but mm-hmm. I believe in the back of the minds of producers, and I think particularly with television more so than print, they are very conscious of being accused of being insufficiently mm-hmm. supportive of America. And mm-hmm. what the right wing has been able to do is to kind of conflate, you know, support for the country with support for Bush's policy.
Who are the David Brocks out there now in the mainstream media?
Well, unfortunately, I mean, there are an awful lot of them. There was a whole group of younger conservative pundits, I guess, who came of age around the time I did, and after Newt Gingrich came into power in Congress, I think was really when they became to be more prominent in the media. The Ann Coulters, the Laura Ingrams, the Jonah Goldbergs of the world. And, you know, they are now, you know, a very steady presence.
Has this right or conservative perspective affected the coverage of the impending war in Iraq, in your opinion, and if so, how?
Yes, I think it has. I think that, I mean, first of all, I think you see more in terms of who is out there offering opinion on the war. I think that you don't have the anti-war perspective represented in the proportion that pro-war sentiment is represented. And I think one classic case of this is that, you know, lately most of the coverage have focused on celebrities who have come out against the war. And I think one of the reasons why, you know, it was incumbent on them to step forward is that they could get the coverage because they're celebrities. I think it's an indictment of the fact that people who, you know, may have more, you know, technical expertise in these matters just aren't really being heard from. And I think part of that has to do with it's broader than a media problem. It's a problem of progressives, liberals not having much of an infrastructure in which they operate. And that goes to just the multi-millions of dollars that the right has spent building up think tanks and advocacy groups. I mean, I was really struck last year during the debate on the war in the summer that the critics of Bush were people like Lawrence Eagleburger and Brent Scowcroft. They were Republicans, and one wondered, where were the Democrats? And I feel that part of the reason there wasn't enough vigorous Democratic scrutiny of Bush back then, when it really could have counted before there was any vote on this issue, is because there's no institutional place where Democrats could work out an alternative foreign policy. There's another reason why the press obviously doesn't have the incentive to cover the war from a more critical point of view, and that's because many leading Democrats supported the war. And so the media dynamic obviously would be somewhat different if, for example, the leading presidential candidates in the Democratic Party were against the war rather than for the war. And so that contributes to the dynamic as well, and that's definitely a part of it.
David Brock, author of The Real Anita Hill, The Seduction of Hillary Rodham, and most recently, Blinded by the Right, a memoir of an ex-conservative. He's also a former columnist for The Spectator and The Washington Times. Tomorrow, Brock reveals more startling details about the workings of the conservative network. Robert Jensen is author of Writing Dissent and an associate professor at the University of Texas at Austin. He spoke in Porto Alegre, Brazil in late January as part of Z Magazine's Life After Capitalism subconference of the World Social Forum. Jensen reflected on the uniqueness of the growing anti-war movement in the U.S.
Let me start by talking about what I think the task of the anti-war movement is, which is not simply to end the coming war against Iraq or try and mitigate the most brutal of its consequences, but to construct a movement that sees not war as the central organizing task, but empire, so that it requires that first we understand the United States as the empire. Now, to those of you from outside of the United States, that may be something akin to understanding that the sun rises in the east. It is obvious. It is not obvious to everyone in the United States. So part of the task is explaining, persuading people within the United States that we are, in fact, an empire. That is becoming somewhat easier because the ruling elite of the United States are beginning to use the term themselves, but in a positive sense. The ruling elite of the United States want the American people to believe that an empire is now acceptable because the United States will be the first benevolent empire in the history of the world. Again, to those of you from outside the country, this may seem laughable, but this is, in fact, what the Bush administration is trying to sell to the American public, the notion of the first benevolent empire, the first empire that goes across the world, not to acquire resources, not to acquire control, but simply to spread peace, justice, and freedom. In the words of our campaign against Afghanistan, enduring freedom. But of course, most of the world knows what it means to endure American-style freedom already. So the task is to put forward that analysis to the American public and make the American public, from my point of view, understand the somewhat unique historical moment and moral obligation the American public has. Because every other empire in history has had subjects. The British were subjects of their government when the British Empire went about its business of conquering the world. In the United States, we are citizens. And we are the first citizens of the empire in world history. And the word citizen is very important because popular movements in the United States over the last two centuries have won through struggle broad and expansive political freedoms in the United States. Those are not illusion, they are real. The United States, at this moment, has the most expansive legal guarantees of freedom of speech, of freedom to organize, that probably exist anywhere. There are some things the United States does very well. Protecting freedom of speech, while it is not perfect, is one of those things. So as citizens of the empire, we have broad political freedoms and the capacity, I believe, to use them to dismantle the empire from within. That is, I think, a pressing and compelling moral responsibility. And that is what I believe is the task of what is called the anti-war movement. But to me, it is not an anti-war movement. It is an anti-empire movement. Its design should be broader than ending a single war or even a series of wars. Its goal should be to dismantle the American empire from within. But there are problems in organizing toward that, and it produces many paradoxes in the anti-empire organizing struggle. The main paradox is, as I said, the political freedoms available to American citizens are broad and real. We are not without our own kinds of state repression, but compared to what those in other countries endure and suffer at the hands of their police, the repression faced by the American public is trivial. It is nothing. I have spoken out strongly in public, in writing, since 9/11 against the American war in Afghanistan, against the Bush administration. Never has there been a hint that I am going to be subject to direct repression. Now, I am in one of the most privileged sectors of society. I am white, I am a professional, I have education and status, so I am protected more than some. But still, the freedoms are there. So the paradox is, the American public has these very expansive freedoms and very little interest in using them. So that is the central task, is how to repoliticize a population that has been depoliticized. It is almost as if, as more and more freedoms are won, they are used less and less. I don't mean that no one is doing organizing in the United States, that no one is working politically. I'm talking about the general trend in the society. There's another central problem in organizing an anti-empire movement in the United States. In most mass movements, popular movements, movements for social justice that have existed, people are struggling to liberate themselves from power and oppression. The motivation for the movement is, in a sense, self-interest. There is an unjust system imposing illegitimate authority on you, and you want to throw off that system. And to do that requires organization, solidarity, compassion for each other, and a mass movement. And one can understand how, even against serious repression, those mass movements exist, build, and are successful in many cases. In the United States, an anti-empire movement has a different task. When one talks about organizing the American middle class, the broad middle class, the people who have the resources, the money, and the time to become involved, essentially what the anti-empire movement is asking people is to not work for their own self-interest to throw off oppression. We are asking them to do something very different. We are asking them to work against their own self-interest. That is to say, the American empire brings benefits to the American middle class, benefits that come from the flow of resources from the global south to the north, cheap labor. The American empire provides material rewards for all of us in the United States. All of us benefit. And the United States is the most affluent society that has ever existed on the planet. In a sense, we have been bought off in the United States. So the task we face is to convince people that they should work in a movement against their own material self-interest. That is very difficult. It's very difficult for anyone, anywhere. It is especially difficult in the United States, this incredibly affluent society that also has been subjected to the most intensive propaganda campaign that the world has ever seen.
Author and Professor Robert Jensen speaking at last month's World Social Forum in Porto Alegre, Brazil, thanks to Sonali Kolhatkar from Pacifica Station KPFK for production assistance. Finally tonight, author Greg Palace spoke with KPFT's Shalini Tripathi about how the Bush family's business dealings have affected its war on terrorism.
One of the documents I uncovered for BBC News, which got a Project Censored award for, you know, not being allowed on the American airwaves, was the story about how the Bush administration hindered FBI and CIA investigations of Saudi Arabian financing of terror, including the Al-Qaeda group, prior to September 11th. Now, I was wondering, you know, why? And so one of the things that I mentioned in the book is that through completely independent sources, I found out about a meeting in June of 1996 in Paris between Saudi Arabian billionaires, some well-known international arms dealers, and the financial arm of Al-Qaeda. This was when the Khobar Towers were attacked in Saudi Arabia and 19 American servicemen were killed. And the Saudis decided, well, rather than kind of apprehend the ne'er-do-wells who did this deed, is that they kind of pay them off and get them out and let them go play in Afghanistan. Now, the problem was, if the FBI cannot follow up on this story, then if you can't follow the money in any investigation, then you don't know what's going on. You can't hunt Osama bin Laden without looking at his checkbook. I mean, that's basic rule of investigation. But the CIA and the FBI were hindered, slowed down during the Clinton administration and stopped during the Bush administration until September 11th. So I was interested, well, who was in that meeting that led the government to kind of avert its gaze? Was there someone in there that needed to be protected? And I now have from two different independent sources, including a national intelligence agency of another nation, a respected one, and someone who had a representative in the meeting as well, that one of the participants was a character named Sheikh Abdullah Baksh. Now, for those of you who are into George Bush family trivia, Baksh, B-A-K-S-H, is usually how it's spelled. You would know that that's the guy who saved Harkin Oil back in the late 80s when George W.'s daddy was president. George W. was an oil man. He had, unfortunately, had a lot of trouble finding oil. But he did find he didn't hit any oil, but he did strike into the pockets of several Gulf sheikhs. And Baksh helped arrange for the refinancing of Harkin Oil when that company was about to go under. So you have the guy who is, you know, when George W. says, well, there's, you know, thousands of people out there who want to kill us, and they're supported by, and we're going to hunt them down and hunt down their supporters. You have to remember that maybe he should be adding, and some of them are my business partners, or we're my business partners. Now, does that mean that Bush said, well, listen, why don't you give some money to Al-Qaeda? It's okay with me, and then they can attack the United States. There's nothing like that. We didn't find any. I have no information that Bush knew in advance about September 11th or, God forbid, any involvement. But there is a prejudice here, working here. We are arresting and detaining everyone named Ahmed in the Midwest and holding them as potential terrorists. Yet people who have, at least from information, which the intelligence agencies want to gather, people who are involved in funding these operations seem to be given a free pass by this administration. So we have to ask. Now, maybe there's good policy reasons. You know, don't bother our Saudi friends. They have their own special ways. The problem is when you give Al-Qaeda money, some of it not only goes into Afghanistan operations, but apparently went to funding flying lessons for guys who don't want to land. We have to ask where the Bush family bank account ends and American foreign policy begins.
Well, I guess another question along those lines is what's happened to guys like the Sheikh Abaksh or his cronies?
What's happened? They've gotten very...
Post-September 11th.
Well, they're doing very well, thank you. And in fact, actually, one of the interesting things is who, you know, when we talk about this war coming up in Iraq, I think it's well to remember, as I discuss in the book, which is who won the last war. And one of the things to look at is, remember, we were promised democracy in Afghanistan and now it's run by kind of warlords and drug dealers. And we've got, we're promised in the last Gulf War that there would be democracy in Kuwait if we went to war with Saddam. We'd free, liberate Kuwait for democracy. I'm still waiting for the elections returns, you know, in Kuwait. So that hadn't happened. But who did win? After Bush Sr. was removed from the White House by the electorate, he wrote a letter to Kuwait's government. When I say government, it's a dictatorship. We call it a royalty, but that's just a hereditary dictatorship. He wrote a letter to the dictators of Kuwait asking them to give an oil drilling concession to Chevron Oil. Now, why was the President of the United States using his authority with these guys? After all, he saved their Rolls Royces. Why is he using the authority of the Oval Office to get an oil concession for Chevron? He says he didn't get any money, Bush Sr., and that's true. What he doesn't mention is that after he got Chevron its oil deal from the Kuwaitis, that Chevron put in over $500,000 into the Republican National Committee to fund the race of his son for president. This is one of the problems. The Bush family is somewhat unique. There's always been kind of a money poisoning of our political process. And that's why the book is called The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, because I keep thinking we're not holding elections anymore. We're kind of holding auctions. But the Bush family is interesting because they use their political connections to build business and use their business connections to fund their politics. And there's a mix which is quite unique to that family or perfected by that family. You know, obviously, the Clintons figured out some very interesting ways of raising money from, you know, selling pardons to nights to spending the night in the Lincoln bedroom. But this is a whole other order of things. And the problem here is where it impinges on national security. We are supposedly fighting a war on terror. But if it gets close to the Bush family, suddenly that's the peace. If there's one place where there's peace on earth, it's anyone who has an investment relationship with the Bush family. They are not targets.
Greg Palast, author of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, speaking with Shalini Tripathi of KPFT in Houston. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. by Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. We had production assistance from Adil Hamad of KPFA and Benta Berkland. Thanks to Pete Karakis, RadioForAll.net, and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. Special thanks also to our consulting producers, Larry Binsky and Sam Husseini. Copies of this program can be ordered from the Pacifica Radio Archives by visiting the website at pacificaarchives.org or by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. If you'd like to support this type of programming, we urge you to visit pacifica.org and make a pledge through our secure online website. Or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. That's 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. You can send us your feedback to peacewatch@pacifica.org. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.